Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. You are a busy entrepreneur architect. You're hustling to find the next project, meet with clients, keep the bills paid, and if you're lucky, find some time to design. So how do you continue to learn what you need to know to grow? How do you find the information and the training you need to be more efficient, more effective, more successful? I know you're busy because I'm an entrepreneur architect too. That's why we built the Entree Architect membership. On the first Wednesday of every month, we invite an expert into the academy, and they teach us about one specific topic on how to succeed at business. 60 minutes every month, live training and Q&A. And then you can get right back to work. And when you're a member, you'll gain access to so much more. Unlimited access to business resources, a comprehensive video library, and a private member forum with hundreds of entrepreneur architects just like you. Everything you need to build a better business is available right now at Entree Architect. Register today at entrearchitect.com/join. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 291, and this week I'm with Paul McLean, and he's sharing how he became an architect to the stars. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, ARCAD, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more at ARCAD.com, and FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. Paul McLean, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Great. Thank you very much and very glad to be here.
It's great having you here. You have an interesting story and I want to share that with the Entree Architect community here. Let me introduce you and so people know who you are. Paul McLean grew up in Ireland where he attended the Dublin Institute of Technology, graduating with honors in architecture in 1994. During this time, he traveled and worked for award-winning architectural practices in London and Dublin and Sydney. And after graduation, he arrived in Southern California and worked for various local architectural firms before establishing his firm, McLean Design, in 2000. Paul's a member of the AIA and works primarily in California and Hawaii. And he works for pretty high-level clients. I've read some articles. You've done some homes for Jay-Z and Beyonce and Calvin Klein, and so some pretty interesting work. He recently released his first book, McLean Design, Creating the Contemporary House. So go check that out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. It was written by Philip Jodidio. Jodidio, is that how you say it?
Thanks.
Jodidio. And it's published by Rizzoli Electa. The book takes us behind the scenes of 21 of the architect's ultra modern homes completed in the past 15 years. It's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful monograph. So, Paul, I shared a little bit about you, a little bit of a background of who you are and what you do. But like everybody, we want to know more about you personally. So I would love for you to tell us your origin story. So go back to where you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and give us the story from that point to where you find yourself today.
Gosh, well, it's a long time ago at this point. I really always wanted to be an architect since I was about 4 years old, according to my mother. And I used to draw houses on the living room floor on paper, build Lego models. It was always houses for me for some reason. That was my main interest. And I guess I was probably around 10 or 11 years old when I found some books in the local library, which would have been mainly Frank Lloyd Wright. There wasn't a very big architecture collection where I grew up in Dublin in the local library, but there were one or two books. It would have been probably just Frank Lloyd Wright and then like pattern books of homes and whatever. And I remember finding that first book and seeing actually Falling Water and being completely fascinated by it and not quite understanding that it was a house back then and trying to get my head around that. So I always, you know, for me, it's always been almost like a vocation. I've always wanted to be an architect. There's never really been anything else. In fact, I don't know what I would do if I wasn't being an architect at all. I have no comprehension of that. Yeah. And I grew up in Dublin, in suburban Dublin, and went to school in the center of Dublin, and did architecture after high school, and got to travel, which was great. I was lucky enough to be able to do a trip around the world when I was about 19 or 20. I disappeared for 15 months and traveled through America and across the Pacific and back through Asia to get home again. And the other thing that was really interesting along my little journey through architecture school was I had a couple of fascinating jobs. I had a job with the National Monuments Service in Dublin. And what they do is they categorize all of the ancient monuments around Ireland. And that was a fascinating job. They would put me on a train with a bicycle and I would go out into the countryside and find ruins and sketch them and catalog them.
Oh, wow. That must have been a lot of fun.
That was probably one of the best summers of my early life. And I mean, if you can ever have a job like that, it couldn't be anything better.
Did you document them? Did you have to measure them and do measured drawings as
Do measured drawings or measured sketch drawings. And but a lot of it was discovery. There's so much in Ireland that way, so many ancient things that it's really that they're not all cataloged yet. So it was trying to find things, or sometimes there was a rumor that down this laneway there might be an ancient castle.
Oh, wow.
And don't find it. So that was really fascinating. And of course you'd meet people along the way as well. They would invite you in for tea and whatever. So there was always stories. One of my favorites, I know we're going way off track here, but one of my favorites was I went down this laneway with a colleague and we found a moat wrapping around what was a castle, but one tower is still intact and the rest of it ruins. And then sitting in the middle was a little white thatched cottage, like sitting right in the middle where the castle used to be, with a lady probably in her 70s who came right out straight away and, you know, offered us tea and, you know, scones and whatever, gave us her stories of, you know, her family living there and her relatives going back several hundred years, and you know what she knew about the castle. So that was a lot of fun.
Was the castle was it related to her, or was her family just sort of claimed that space after?
Her family had kind of claimed that space later. But even still, interestingly, when I worked there, every time we would talk about buildings, because there was back in that time in the early 90s, there was a lot of money flowing into Ireland for restoration and for tourism. So they were often building interpretive centers and museums and so on. And even, you know, infrastructure like utilities, like toilet blocks and whatever that people could use when they visited these sites. But I was always trying to convince them they needed to do a really contemporary structure rather than trying to, you know, replicate what was there. Right. So
did you ever succeed at that?
I might have done okay on a couple of toilet blocks, you know, but I think, you know, in general, I think where that went and which is exciting is they started a competition process. So a lot of young architects in Ireland have designed interpretive centers and museums, and they've all been interesting how they come about, and the designs have been, some of them have been spectacular, and some of them have been just world-class, I think. So yeah, that was really interesting. And the other thing that happened was I worked for a year in Dublin for one of my tutors at college, and they were involved in a group called Group 91, which was a collection of 8 different architecture firms who were, back then, the city, the city had a lot of problems, and there was a lot of vacant sites. It was before the economy took off, which is kind of at the late 80s, early 90s. And they were very much influenced by European urbanism, you know, like Aldo Rossi and some of the stuff that was going on in Berlin at the time. And so there was a competition to take a section of the city, which had originally actually been designated for demolition so that they could build a giant transport interchange. And what they came up with instead was a plan to knit it back together using insertions of new contemporary cultural projects and then linking, creating new streets between different sections. That's now really the center of like tourism in the middle of Dublin right now, 20 years later. So it was fascinating to get to, at that early age, to be involved. They won the competition. So it was like take a year off school and try and help develop a couple of buildings. We had 2 museums to work on. And of course, back then, this was all before anyone was drafting computers and stuff. It was all hand drawing and hand sketching and perspectives, you know, which is something that I was luckily, something I always was pretty good at, drawing. And the jobs was because I could draw perspective drawing, color drawing, and so on. And you know, that was critical back then, just, you know, 30 years ago now, I guess.
Yeah. So did you let's continue with the origin story, because I was going to ask you a question that would have brought us to current time, or almost current time. So you're traveling the globe. And
scraping, you know, pennies together to move from place to place, back in Dublin, do a year off again, finish college, and then had some friends who live in California and decided to come out for the summer, and kind of ran out of money, I guess, originally back then, decided to stay. But I'd always wanted to come to LA because, I mean, as I went through college and discovered more about architecture, I mean, Los Angeles has always been, and in many ways still is, one of the most important places for residential architecture, I think, for people have been experimenting here for over 100 years with contemporary design, and that's still going on today. And there's not many places, you know, residential architectural design is can be hard in many urban environments to find sites, or, you know, have people have enough money. It takes a, you know, there's a mixture of things that have to come together that I think California is particularly suited to, in terms of the way, I mean, it's a very, obviously very suburban city, but it does mean that there's decent sized lots to work with. There's hillsides and views, and people who live here have the resources to invest in architecture. And then being California, especially, I think people are open to new ideas and to being a little bit experimental with what's essentially an enormous amount of money. You know? So I felt like this would be a great place to try and do residential architecture. So when I got here, I worked on trying to find architects that I could work for who did that type of thing. And I worked for a firm in Laguna Beach for about 5 years before we set up our firm, and learned a lot about residential design, and, you know, met some people along the way that helped me, you know, connect me to people, clients, potential clients, and that's how we got going.
So you're sort of stranded in LA as a student, I guess a young professional at that point.
Finished architecture school. Yeah.
And so were you licensed in Dublin at that point? I mean, in Ireland?
No, I would have come straight out of college And they have a system a little bit different than here, but similar in that there is a licensing process that happens after you finish university. So I mean, I really, apart from my student jobs, which, you know, I had jobs every summer, you know, with architecture firms, I never really practiced architecture at all in Ireland. It all happened here.
Yeah. And so you found someone to work with, and they were doing contemporary residential architecture.
Right. In Laguna Beach. Yeah.
And so doing some pretty nice projects right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, they were great projects, and it really cemented for me that that's what I wanted to do with my career and my life. And I think that it's an interesting, compared to other forms of architecture, there is a skill set you need to do, because you need to really be comfortable dealing with people. And you have to understand that for most of these people, this is pretty much all the money they'll ever spend, or the most amount of money they'll ever spend on one thing in their lives. And it's a very nerve-wracking process. And so you have to be able to be patient and be comfortable dealing with people and able to communicate well to them in a non-architectural way, that they understand what you're trying to get across and that they can be supportive of it. And I think architects are not necessarily trained to do that. And so it's some skills I wish at architecture school, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but I wish people would think about that a little bit more, that it's not really always about the design. It's about trying to find a way to marry the design to the client, which is really, in a way, a form of marketing. You know, you need to be able to market yourself successfully. So I'm Irish. I know how to talk. We're all pretty good at talking. And that helps. Having an accent sometimes helps as well. But that was really how I got going, was learning to talk to people, learning to talk in front of design review boards and city council meetings to convey the idea without, you know, getting lost in the idea in a way that people could understand the narrative. And, you know, that led me. Doing those presentations got me some exposure in the local community that led people to start to approach me independently to see if I'd be interested in working on projects. And I met this lady, and she had bought a lot which came with a set of plans for a Mediterranean style home. And as we were talking about it, listening to her, she was describing more like a mid-century home or something very typical California that was open to the environment and had retractable glass walls. And I told her that really, it didn't make sense to try and rework these plans. She would be better off to start over, because she just was not going to get what she wanted out of that. And that conversation ended. And then about 6 months later, funnily enough, on New Year's Day 2000, she called me back and said it was a new millennium and she had decided that's what she wanted to do. So I worked on that project for 4 or 5 months before I felt ready to quit the day job, and then that's where we started with this first house. And it was an amazing thing to be doing. It was like about 3,000 square feet altogether, and made of three kind of transparent boxes sitting in a canyon. And you couldn't ask for a better project to start a firm with. So, and you know, obviously after that we attracted other people, and it was a great time. Around then, the economy was starting to pick up, people were starting to build again, and so we had two or three projects within a year, and after that we were, you know, haven't looked back since.
So that first client, she came to you through word of mouth, that you were working with this other firm, and you were presenting, and so people sort of understood your skill level and your personality and the way you were handling people.
That's important, for people, for younger architects to understand, is you got to get yourself out there. Sort of, you have to be out there that people can see you. Like Bill Clinton used to say, like 90% is just showing up. Right,
you know? Right, exactly. So that personality, it sounds like through what you're describing, that a lot of your early success came because you were aware of this ability that communication was important. This connection to people was important. To be a successful architect, was that something that that you learned through experience, or was that something that someone at that firm you were working for was teaching you? How did you learn that?
I think I learned it more through experience and being exposed to other architects, including the firm I was working at. He was a great communicator, as were some of the other architects I previously worked for. I worked for a firm in Sydney for a year, and when I was on my big trip, and that was an architect who just specialized again in home design, and we would meet clients and I would see how he would interact with them and how he made them feel about their designs and how he brought them into the process of designing a house and made them part of it. And I think I learned it through experience, just watching other people. And like I said before, drawing was a big factor in it, because I was able to draw in three dimensions and perspective renderings and so on. And when you don't have a portfolio, I mean, that's what you have to see. But that, what's a little bit different, I guess, or interesting about that compared to today, where we can generate so many wonderful images, you know, with computers, is that the artistry was also a selling point that people were attracted to. They liked to watch you draw. They liked to see the drawings. Sometimes they would ask if they could keep the drawings and put them on their wall, you know, and that's something that is, I think, kind of lost a little bit today. Even I don't draw anymore because, you know, you can produce a 3D model and get like 20 renderings off it of different views and angles and move it and change it. And it's just so much more productive. But I think that did really help back then in, you know, the beginning of the century. So long ago, 20 years ago, it really helped me get off the ground because people were, you know, they had seen me talk. They had to take a chance. I had to try and, you know, sell them on the idea that I could do this, which is part of the problem. It's like they have to spend all this money and someone has to, you have to convince them that you're actually going to be able to pull this off, actually help them build this project. It won't all be a desperate failure.
Yeah, exactly. I think the ability to sketch, the ability to draw that architects have, I often say that that's our superpower as architects. Because when people, when lay people who are not architects see us do it, they are fascinated by it. They're amazed by it, right? It's like it's like this magic trick that we can do.
Yeah, and I think we shouldn't forget that amongst all this technology, because that almost like a performance art. You know, it's something that they're attracted to, and showing them some beautiful 3D renderings doesn't have the same impact at all as you sitting there with a piece of sketch paper and a pen and scribbling out ideas and then feeling like there's the kernel of something coming out of your brain is now appearing on paper that's going to become a real live thing in the world. Is, you know, it's very exciting for people.
Yeah. And I think it's even more important today, because when we first started, because you're around the same age as I am, you graduated a year after I did, and so it's today it's even more important because it's a differentiator, because nobody's doing it. When we first started, everybody was doing it because that's how you
did
architecture,
right?
We sketched and then we did hand drawings on a drafting board. But today everybody's doing computer drawings, and even, you know, the younger architects are exclusively, you know, they're starting on in the computer. They're not sketching anything. And so the ability to sketch and the ability to take your idea and put it on a piece of paper in front of a client could actually differentiate you from everybody else who they're talking with. And so that's a skill that you should use and leverage as a young architect.
I definitely couldn't agree more. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. A while ago, a few years ago, a client who will remain nameless, I remember like the first time I went to her house, she actually put a roll of sketch paper in front of me and a pen, and she just said, "Draw something." I'm like, like, draw what?
Anything.
You know? I'm like, really? Anything? So I just start doodling, and then she started giggling, you know, and she was so excited about the idea of drawing and painting and coloring. You know, for her, that was just such a thing. But I also think, Mark, it's interesting when, you know, when you draw or you're sketching, especially when you're just sketching and you're kind of ruminating on ideas and you're kind of, the pen is just kind of moving kind of freely, or the pencil in your hand. And it's amazing how sometimes you see almost between the lines something that grabs your attention.
Right.
And I, you know, that's obviously how I grew up and how you grew up, but I don't know how you do that on a computer.
Right.
You know, because you have to make more deliberate decisions in a way. You have to say, I want to draw a line in 3D coordinates, and you start. Whereas on a piece of paper, it's just kind of, is it a section? Is it a plan? Is it three-dimensional? I don't know. It's just a doodle, and it just slowly becomes something that grows out of that, like organically. So I think that's something that, you know, could easily get lost, as well as being something you can really leverage to your advantage.
Yeah, I agree. So that original client, three boxes in the valley, how did that become, you know, what you have today, what you're doing today that's, you know, published in the book?
Well, I think it started, you know, interestingly, that lady chose to build the house herself. So that was also a big journey for both of us. We had to spend a lot of time trying to figure that out. And it's interesting. She did it the right way. She took, her name was Patty Civic. She gave up her day job, because I don't think you can build a house if you're doing a job and you're turning up for half an hour in the morning
right.
to meet someone. But she really, really put her heart and soul into it. And that inspired me a lot. And I think as we started to gather clients, and I was at that time almost exclusively in Laguna Beach, which is a small beachside town in California, with you know, a lot of expensive homes and complicated hillsides. So, and there's a design review board, and the design review board, you know, was you know, the a big advantage and the bane of my existence at the same time, because there's a lot of neighborhood input, but if you can successfully navigate the process, you end up getting more clients, because people are most concerned when they move to town and they want to build a house. They're most concerned, like, how can we get through the design review board? So being, you know, having that first project approved and being able to draw it in three dimensions, which, like I said, back then there were no digital tools for that, no PowerPoint presentations or anything like that. So that was for the board members who are not architects mainly. That was a big advantage. And also the architects on the board, when they used to have architects on the board, they don't anymore. They were also very encouraging, obviously, you know, because they like to help younger architects kind of get a foothold. So that was really how we built our firm in the first 4 to 5 years, just meeting people, or, you know, people telling their friends or their neighbors, how about you'd look at this person for a home. And sometimes we ended up doing homes next door to each other because we had to spend a lot of time interacting with the neighbors as part of, you had to hold public meetings. And so you stand on the street and have 30, 40 people show up and have to explain to them why this house was appropriate for the neighborhood. But that was also surprisingly a good way of getting new clients, because people will come and listen to you and then they'll be like, well, I have a lot down the street, and how about you look at that? If they liked how you presented it and thought you were being fair to both sides. And there was a lot of compromise in that process too, which was humbling and a big learning experience. That, you know, coming out, you think your designs are all going to be exactly the way you want them, and reality is you've got not only your client and their wishes and desires and your budget constraints, and you've now got neighbor constraints on top of that, where they're worried about their view, or they don't like the color, or they don't like privacy concerns, and you're trying to keep this design together while you navigate all those different requirements.
Yeah, and it comes back to communication, right? It comes back to communication skills. That when you're, not only do you need those communication skills to be recognized and acknowledged by potential clients, but now through a very complicated approval process with a board potentially of completely, you know, non-architecturally educated reviewers, which is frustrating for any architect to have to present architectural design to a panel of people who don't understand how architecture is designed. And so, right. So again, you're right back to that conversation of having the communication skills and the people skills to successfully navigate that process, and do it, you know, do it successfully over and over, which makes you recognized in the community. Again, there's people see that you can do that, and now that's a skill that you can promote and leverage for the next project.
Right, and I think if you look at the most successful architects everywhere, most of them are incredible educators, and that's the business. I mean, they may have 200 or 300 people working for them, but the reason they're the person there is because they're the one who can communicate to people and interact with, whether it's the community or politicians or developers or whomever it is they have to work with. It really comes down to that ability to talk to people.
We will come right back to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entre Architect, Arcat, and FreshBooks. If you work with specifications in your firm, you probably have come across outdated manufacturer specs with confusing notes, products that no longer exist, or maybe even companies that no longer exist. Maybe you even pay for specifications. Do you do that? Stop. There's a better way to find manufacturer specifications for your project documentation. It's Arcat. Arcat.com. Arcat is the number one most used website for finding building product information and has a free library with over 1,400 up-to-date accurate specifications. 1,400 up-to-date accurate specifications. Our cat's specs are written by FCSI, CCS, and AIA professionals based on manufacturers' data. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right specifications for your project and quickly download them into multiple formats for free. Google can't do that. You don't even have to register. Go now to RCAT.com. That's RCAT.com, A-R-C-A-T.com, and start building better content today. Do you remember when you started your small firm? It was not easy. It took lots of late nights, early mornings, and maybe even the occasional all-nighter. Bottom line, you have been insanely busy ever since. So why not make things a little bit easier for yourself? Well, our friends at FreshBooks have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners like us. It's simple, intuitive, and keeps you way more organized than that dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds, and then get them paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. File expenses even quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. And the best part? FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools that you need when you need them without ever having to learn the ins and outs of accounting. Join the 24 million people who've used FreshBooks. Try it for free for 30 days. No catch, no credit card, free for 30 days. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. RCAT and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So the portfolio that you have today, what type of, how are you getting the projects that you're getting today? Is it the same thing? Is it becoming an expert in the process and just continuing the evolution of that those skills?
Yeah, I think so. To a degree, we moved kind of away from, you know, we got a bigger audience in a way. I mean, that's kind of changed a little bit in the sense that we still get most of our projects through word of mouth. But along the way, as more work has been published and as we've worked in different communities, it's exposed us to more people. And I think we started to do work in Greater Los Angeles around 2006, 2007. And the house we did, one particular project, and funny enough, I was there last night, was the house we did on Blue Jay Way, which is in our book, but that's been published a lot, that we finished around 2008 and was most recently owned by the DJ Vici. That project was probably the seminal project that helped us to get a leg up and move beyond the smaller communities we were working in that separated us, because it was designed for someone, and then when the recession happened in 2008, they needed to sell it, and it sold for a lot of money, even though the economy was collapsing all around us at that stage. And that opened a lot of people's eyes, especially in the real estate world of West LA. And then we started to get approached by people who wanted us to do designs. And as we finished those designs up 2 or 3 years later and the economy started to pick up, and some of those were for sale, which was very interesting to me. Like during the recession, we were basically working on speculative projects, which sounds bizarre. Normally it's the other way around. And but by the time the recession was over and those projects were on the market, they were knocking it out of the park in terms of their sales price and so on. And the reality is then that attracts more people to you, and people start talking about the homes, and so it started to build from there. So we've got very, very lucky to get to do that one house, and that it got as much exposure as it does. And it's interesting that you can look back and see, for me it's very interesting that I can look back and see this one house and what a difference it made in the career, even though we were working on, you know, 20 or 30 homes prior to that over the course of 7 or 8 years. It's like, this is the one project that switched the way our business works around. And as we build more and more, then I think as the projects get bigger, people, you know, they're looking for architects, and they're looking for people who obviously have experience at doing these type of homes. And as the budget in a way gets larger, they become a little bit more conservative, I think. They're not willing perhaps to take a chance as much as they were on some of the smaller projects. I mean, it's a big difference financially for a client between doing a 1,500 square foot home and a 20,000 square foot home. And so in a way, they end up with just, there's certain people who are doing that style of home in that neighborhood, and then we get called. So there's a little less word of mouth. And then the biggest change actually in terms of that in the last couple of years has been Instagram. Which when I think it was my wife started by encouraging me to go on Instagram about 2 years ago, and we started posting. And our original thought was it would, you know, a lot of our clients were on Instagram, and it's a way just to kind of remind them, hello, we're still here if you're thinking of things, or just, you know, keeps letting them see you, putting you in front of them. But really recently, in the last year or so, we've started to get clients just purely off posts on Instagram in different places. Not necessarily locally, but we have a project now in Las Vegas, and we have a project in Thailand, and both of those came from just people watching Instagram. So that's been, I think Instagram is an amazing tool for architects because it's so visual.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So how are you leveraging Instagram? What are you posting, and how often are you posting?
Usually posting once a day, and we're posting imagery, just imagery of houses, concentrating on the photos, not really talking too much, which I think that people just like to flick through images. So we're trying to we look for more arresting photos. It's just interesting looking at how it works. People don't seem, at least for our perspective, they're more interested in the kind of the bigger shots of the entire property, the house, you know, nighttime shots all lit up with swimming pools, things like that. I've lifestyle photos, I think, would be a way to put it. We've tried doing weeks where we've just posted bathrooms or kitchens and stuff, and then that hasn't really worked out. People don't tend to like them. It's just interesting watching how that works. So it's the big money shots, I guess, that are the ones people are most interested in.
And all professional, very, very high quality photography as well.
Yeah. So we're always, you know, it's always professional photography from our projects that we're posting.
Right. Because, I mean, you look at some Instagram accounts and it's more of sort of a behind the scenes look at the architecture firm. It looks like your Instagram feed is really a photographic portfolio of the work that you do out of, you know, the very high quality images, big money shots, you know, the swimming pool, the overhead view, the cool angle on the glass box, you know, all those things that catch your eye right away and you stop and you want to look at it.
Yeah, that's our goal, and it seems to be working. But we've been trying also to mix it up a little bit and put some more personal, maybe more personal from the business perspective, not necessarily, you know, being too, we want to maintain privacy for our families and stuff, but just like if we have events at homes, or if like there was a wedding recently at one of our homes and we went to the wedding and that was a lot of fun, and so we posted some pictures from the wedding and so on, but you know, still showing off the house in the background.
Yeah, exactly. And so and you're well published. In addition to the book, you're published in magazines and online. How are you doing that? Are you working with a PR agency or a marketing company, or are you doing that in-house?
We are working with a PR company. Since we launched the book, we hired somebody because we had never worked on a book before, and it was we were working with Rizzoli, and they were amazing, but obviously their goal is to get the book published, and then it's up to us to help get the book out there and sold. So we hired a PR firm to help us with that, and Christine Anderson is the name of the lady there, and they've been phenomenal. It's really been interesting to see how much more their input has helped to get the book out there, and also to get us into magazines and so on. And there does definitely seem to be a need for people that have connections with editors and writers. And I don't think it's in any way nefarious or anything. I think it's just that, like many things, you just aren't on their radar. You need someone who can they trust, who can say, hey, you should pay attention to this person and what they're doing, or take a look at this, and to get someone to get you over that line. And then they're like, oh yeah, that's really nice, I'd like to put that in my magazine, works great. But if you try and just cold call these magazines and so on, then you don't really get much response usually. So I think it's been Creative Arts is the name of the company, but they've been amazing at that. And, you know, it's interesting even just following how the book's been selling. You can follow it a little bit on Amazon and so on. We've seen that where they've managed to get the book into magazines and so on, you'll see a little bump in the number of sales figures and stuff. So that's, yeah, I think they definitely are worth the money we pay them.
Yeah, that's actually how we got connected. You know, she reached out to me, and she does a good job, because I typically delete every one of those requests. if it's not somebody that I reach out to or one of my team reach out to that we recruit to come onto the podcast, very rarely do we bring on somebody who is being solicited to us, or solicited to us. It's just her approach and the way she handled it was very professional. And, so I said, well, let me learn more. And yeah. And so, and I'm glad we did, because it's a really interesting conversation, because you have very interesting work and you have an interesting firm, and it's great to sort of hear the background, of how your firm works. I had one other question before we wrapped up here. I don't remember what it was. That's what it was. I wanted to know a challenge. So in somewhere in your career, was there any sort of big challenge that you had to overcome? And how did you overcome it?
It's funny, but it really relates to the rest of our conversation. It's all about communication. I mean, there have been challenges. There have been times when things have gone very wrong with clients, on job sites, miscommunication. Things that turned out not to be mistakes we've made some pretty big mistakes. It's amazing, you know, sometimes we're still here. But the thing I learned from that is that the first thing you need to do, I mean, the way we approach problems when they happen, and is we try and figure out, first of all, how the problem came about, and what is the best solution. And then as soon as we possibly can, we just go straight up there and apologize if necessary, explain what went wrong, take responsibility for it, and then offer a solution. And I think that people often, particularly maybe it's especially younger architects who are maybe perhaps not so quite so confident, you know, to you know, where they are in the career, the danger is to kind of bury your head in the sand and hope it goes away. And that never works.
Yes.
And that's what leads to bigger problems like lawsuits and so on. And we've been very fortunate to be able to navigate, because our clients are obviously very successful and very wealthy generally. And so they have resources, you know, and so they could make our lives very difficult.
Yeah, and there's, you know, they've an attorney on hand, ready. They just say, sick them, and it's, you know, they go attack, right? And so,
yeah, there you go. So, so I think that's probably the thing I learned along the way that I feel like I need to pass on. And it really relates right back to that communication issue, that, you know, if you need to find ways to communicate your ideas and communicate what's going on to people and be upfront and open so that they feel that, you know, you're being honest with them and that they're getting value for money and that they're, you know, that they're not being taken advantage of. You know, people, I think, like we said at the beginning, when you're designing a home, and this doesn't matter if it's a 1500 square foot house or a 100,000 square foot house, you know, everyone has essentially the same worries. They're worrying, can they afford it? They're worrying, are they doing the right thing? They're hesitant about every decision they're making, you know, because it's such an important decision. And it's easy, you know, as an architect, when you're working on a lot of projects, or, you know, to think about, oh, why are they so obsessed about, you know, where the broom closet's going? I mean, that doesn't sound so important, but you have to adjust your thinking about that, you know, because, you know, they're the person that's for them is an important thing right now. And that's something that's keeping them awake at night. And you'd be amazed that, like, I've had clients where I've been on vacation, I've come back and they've been stuck on what color purple the door should be. You know, is it this purple, that color? And they've been losing sleep over it, you know? And, you know, instead of taking that lightly, you need to take that seriously and just, you know, help. That's what you're there for. And they're asking, that's why they have you, to help them make those decisions as well. Another interesting little side note is a client of mine that I remember going to a first interview with a lady and her husband, and she told me that they lived in a very conventional house, very traditional, in a suburban part of Greater Los Angeles. And she told me that she wanted her new house house to be very homey. And I was thinking about this word homey, and I'm thinking, gosh, well, you know, if you look at our work, it's not really how I would describe our work. It's homey. And I was kind of thinking, where is this going? I don't know what to do with this. You know, are we talking log cabins or, you know, French Tudor designs? And then we went to look at some homes that we'd done, and I took her to this house that, you know, people would say looks a little bit, you almost can't tell if the pictures are black and white in color because the palette is so stark and everything is so perfectly gray, black, or white. And she walked in and said, yes, this is really homey. And I was completely taken aback. But so her perception of what she meant was something not on my radar. And that was a very interesting lesson to learn, that to try and figure out what your client really wants at the end of the day. It's not what you want, it's what they want. And I mean, for me, we're in this tremendously fortunate position that we've had the chance to build all these great homes. And obviously, when we get a new client, they're coming to us based on our portfolio. So I don't really have to worry anymore about whether they like what we do, because otherwise they wouldn't be calling. But I need to figure out what they like and how to marry those two together. You know, so I think that's always a big challenge, but that's the exciting bit too. And you never know what's going to come out of that.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear you talk about the challenges and how you overcome them and how you be honest, even at that very high level with clients with a lot of money and a lot of resources and a lot of support, to them. It takes a lot of courage to say, yes, we made a mistake and here's what the mistake is and here's how we're going to fix it. And I've written articles about that. I agree with you that you take accountability, and it actually builds your credibility and builds your trust with the client because you did, you were held accountable, you know, for the issue. It's very interesting. So let's wrap up with our last final question here, Paul. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
For themselves for tomorrow, or for the world? I mean, what's the question, I guess?
It's intended to be for their firm and for themselves, yeah. But it can be answered any way that you'd like to answer it.
Well, I think, you know, obviously we're like we've talked about, marketing and communication are really, really important, obviously. And we live in a very digital world. And it's interesting that there's opportunities even for very small firms. I mean, our firm is not very large, but you can do work, not necessarily locally, you can do work all around the world in the way things are today. So I think trying to be open to that, but to prepare for it, like we talked about, concentrate, instead of thinking of portfolio just in terms of what buildings you have or what you know, what the design looks like, think of it in terms of what are you trying to communicate to people, how you're the people you're trying to target, how does this relate to them versus how does it relate to my portfolio. You know, it's like, how do I get them? And then try and find places where you can get yourself exposed that way through whatever means that is, doing informal communication or going to places where you can meet people that they can, you got to be there. They have to know you're there. I think that's probably the biggest lesson. And I found over the years, it's amazing how quickly people forget about that you're there. You know, it's not on purpose. Just everyone's life is so busy. And it's the same for me with, like, we've worked with some great contractors, and I'll suddenly bump into a contractor, or he'll cold call me, like, gosh, I haven't worked with that guy for 5 years, and he was great. Why did I forget? I like that guy. I like working with him. That was a good project. You know, but it's just, they're not on your front radar because we're all so busy. So I think just trying to make sure you're out there and make sure that people understand what you're trying to do. I don't know if that's any good advice at all.
Yeah, but it's fantastic advice. Fantastic advice. So the book is McLean Design. So it's McLean, McLean Design, Creating the Contemporary House, published by Rizzoli. And the website, if you want to go check out Paul's website, it's McLeanDesign.com. As mentioned, very active on Instagram. Go follow him at McLean Design. Paul, this has been a great half hour, a little 45 minutes or so. Great conversation. I appreciate
you so much
being so transparent and so honest with the way that your firm has grown and the way that you're practicing. I appreciate it, and I thank you for joining us here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks a million, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for sharing this and every episode of Entree Architect podcast with your friends. The link for today's episode with Paul McLean is entrearchitect.com/episode291. entrearchitect.com/episode291. That is how we get the word out about Entree Architect and the Entree Architect podcast, how we can keep growing and keep making a difference in the profession of architecture. Share the link, entrearchitect.com/episode291 with Paul McLean. And if you are looking for a simple, efficient way to learn what you need to know to grow your small firm, then join the hundreds of other entrepreneur architects who've already registered at Entree Architect Membership. 60 minutes every month, live training and Q&A. Then you can get back to work. Join us today at entrearchitect.com/join. It's that simple. entrearchitect.com/join. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Spread the word and have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.